Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode LIV, There and Back Again, An Emperor's Tale. When we last left Hadrian, he had taken the title of Princeps whether the Senate liked it or not. Now safely secure in his new position, he sets about doing what he's always wanted to do, touring the provinces and taking a ridiculously long gap year. For the next 4 years, Hadrian will be living his life on the road, and he leaves his mark on every bit of the empire that he can find. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Hadrian starts his first imperial tour in 121 CE, so he's been emperor for 4 years. But as we know, it took him a long time to get back home, so he's already had a little tour on the way back. But this time he kind of goes out with a will to see a lot of the empire, and he's going to be away for 4 years. And he goes all over the place. He goes to the Gallic provinces, so in the northwest. He spends a long time there in 121-2. He also goes over, and this is still conceptually a big thing for the Romans, goes over to Britannia, so crosses the English Channel, and then comes back down south, back into the Gallic provinces and into modern Spain, Tarraconensis. So he's kind of doing the western strip, down Britannia, Gaul, Hispania in 121-2. And in 123, he moves over straight over to the east to Syria in order to neutralize a threat that seems to be coming from Parthia. So he's got to negotiate a kind of keeping of the peace over in Syria. And then he's in the east. So he stays in what we think of as modern Turkey again, travels around. The Romans have, three or four provinces in that area. And then he starts to go where he really wants to be, I think, all along, which is he moves into the Greek world. But remember, the Greek world is really Western Turkey.
Yeah.
Is part of that world in antiquity. And he moves into what we think of as Greece proper, the Roman provinces of Achaia and Macedonia. Then Sicily, which is kind of still the Greek world because it's colonized by Greeks so early on, so it's culturally Greek. So he ends up spending 2 years, 124-5, very much in the Greek cultural world, the Greek milieu, and immersing himself in that. So it's a big tour of everywhere in a way, or almost everywhere.
He visits everywhere in the Roman Empire, and he spends 4 years doing this, just this trip, which is more time than he spent in Rome so far as emperor. But why is he on this trip at all? This is more than every Roman emperor has travelled. There hasn't been a Roman emperor who visits every province, for example, before Hadrian. So what's he doing?
I mean, most Roman emperors, when they travel, have been primarily engaged in warfare.
Mm.
And this is very specifically not about warfare, perhaps with the exception of that trip over to Syria to stop a war happening. It's much more a kind of almost seems like a diplomacy mission to show himself around the empire, to make clear, I guess, to the provinces who's in charge, but also to appear as more than somebody who, if you think about the people in these various provinces, and the Roman Empire has grown so big by now, they only get to see the emperor perhaps on coinage.
Mm.
That's their relationship with the emperor. And of course, not everybody in all of these provinces got to see Hadrian, but he gets to see the provinces and have a presence there. And most places he goes, there will be an arch built in his honor, or he will pay for a building locally. He loved to pay for buildings to be built locally. This is how he leaves his mark all over the place.
Yeah, because his name gets put on that building.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's a reminder always that Hadrian was the emperor of this place.
So there will be a plaque at the very least, or there will be, you know, a temple paid for or something as a reminder that Hadrian was there. And I think that it's partly about the period in which he's living, that the empire is starting to change and become what we might call multicultural, so that, you know, citizenship it's sort of increasing exponentially to the point where not that much later we're going to have just kind of blanket citizenship throughout the empire declared. Because Hadrian and his predecessor Trajan actually come from one of the provinces, although they are Roman citizens, that probably helps with this idea that Rome isn't just Rome. It's not even just Italy. It's all of these other places too. So it's kind of giving recognition to that, that Rome is something that's spread much further. We've kind of consolidated that idea that you can be Roman in all these different places, which has always been true, but is now much more solidly true because if you remember when we first had Gauls in the Senate, which is a while ago now, it was under the Emperor Claudius.
Yeah.
But it was very controversial. Mm. So even though these people were Roman citizens, and so technically it should be okay, there were clearly in the Roman mind kind of grades of citizen.
Yeah.
And I think that that, to a certain extent, is being leveled out.
Okay.
And I think Hadrian's travels are a sort of sign of that, that he wants to go to these other places.
So the emperor doesn't travel alone. So what kind of retinue can we envision him traveling with?
Oh, it would have been huge. It would have been a big kind of parade coming into town.
So you'd have soldiers with you, you'd have courtiers. Were senators going with him? There'd be attendees.
Yeah, and probably people came and went, especially senators.
And then there'd be people just going, oh, they're going to Spain. I wouldn't mind a trip. I'm going to hitch my wagon to that wagon train, so to speak.
Possibly so. And we imagine that it might be rather like when armies move, or perhaps not quite as big as an army. You know, you get sort of followers to sell things to the people on this trip or to provide for them in whatever way and make souvenirs that, you know, are about Hadrian being in a particular place.
Come and get your Hadrian pillows, your throw cushions.
Yeah, I'm sure all of that existed. It's a shame it's gone. So we can imagine that this was a big deal, Hadrian travelling around.
So there would have been animals as well.
Certainly food, horses.
Food, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. So when provinces see this coming in the distance, they've got to put this up, don't they? They've got to look after these people, tend them. So it's a big financial thing as well for them to roll into your town.
But it's worth it because Hadrian is a generous emperor and he will contribute to the local economy, I was going to say. And I guess he does. I mean, he's paying for buildings to be built at various places, and obviously that uses local workforce and it leaves something material behind. And of course, he's not going to eat everyday food you have, so he's going to want something special, so it's worth putting it on for him. And we don't know all of the details, but I imagine that there was best behaviour and things were polished up for the emperor being around.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
A lot of flowers suddenly appear when the queen is somewhere. Probably this was also a chance to spruce up wherever Hadrian was staying.
Yeah. So what do the sources tell us directly about the experience of travelling with Hadrian?
Well, he seems to have been very, very hands-on. Dio tells us that he actually drilled the men, the soldiers, when he was around them. And he led a very vigorous life himself. So he was out hunting, he was on horseback, and direct quote, "He covered his head neither in hot weather nor in cold, but alike amid German snows and under scorching Egyptian suns, he went about with his head bare." Setting a good example, says Dio, for everybody else. Dio's actually quite complimentary about him and says this is why the empire was mostly at peace, because other people saw him and saw him kind of participating and being up for anything, as we would say, and admired him. He also is supposed to have been so out and about, and he was a great enthusiast for hunting, that he sometimes got into scrapes. So when he was hunting on one of his trips, he broke his collarbone and Dio says came near to getting his leg maimed. So he's a bit of a risk taker in terms of these outdoor pursuits.
At least it sounds like he's enjoying his holiday. All right, so let's break his travels down a little bit in these first 4 years. So the first place that he goes is to Gaul along the Danube. So what's he doing there?
To get to Gaul, he goes through what we would think of as southern Germany, I guess Germanic areas. And it isn't just a matter of travelling. There does seem to be some intention of strengthening some of the more porous borders, some of the areas that it's difficult to keep people out of. In the Germanic area, there's a wooden fence built, so a palisade in 121, which helps control that border, which is a protection against, presumably against peoples from the other side.
Yeah.
At least a chance to stop them, which implies that there is at least perceived trouble from the Germanic tribes.
It's also keeping his troops busy.
Yes, indeed. We can see on Trajan's column this constant building of forts. I mean, that's part of an actual war.
Mm.
But this is something that troops engage in to keep them fit, especially if they're stationed on a border where there can potentially be trouble.
Yeah, okay.
But much more permanent than that is when he gets to Britannia. The famous Hadrian's Wall is built, which goes from one coast to the other along northern Britannia. It's 80 miles long, and it's a very solid material reminder that the Romans were here, and this is the furthest they're going.
So it's given that that is, crudely speaking, civilization on one side of the wall and the barbarians on the other side. Was it that easy?
Depends what you call civilization.
As in, was that what the wall was for?
The wall was a divider, and it was a divider to stop the so-called barbarians coming into the Roman province.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a defensive wall. It's got forts all the way along it and turrets. Forts, some of which are directly joined to the wall, that would have housed about 500 to 1,000 soldiers. So it's a military installation, very definitely there for keeping people out, which implies that this was seen as a threat. I mean, there are always skirmishes. You know, the Romans see the inhabitants of what they call Caledonia or Scotland as dangerous. And that's reported by Tacitus back in the Agricola work. These were very fierce people who could be a threat to the province. And if you think about how remote that is for the Romans, it's already over the English Channel, and it's right in the northern part of this most distant province. Remember, they thought of Britannia as Ultimus, as the furthest away anyway. I think that it's important to have a structure like that there conceptually for them as a way of marking their intent on the land. They're going to hold everything to the south of that.
This wall was a heavy structure. It wasn't like the palisades that he put up in Gaul, was it?
No, it's made of stone. You can still go there and walk along it.
You're from near there, aren't you?
I grew up near there.
So what's it like?
It's not as high as it once was.
Yeah.
But as I say, you can walk along it because it's up to 3 meters thick. That's about 10 feet. It's got all these forts that you can go visit. So perhaps one of the most famous ones is Vindolanda, which is now, it's got a museum attached to it. And that's one of the famous ones because lots of letters were found there, which tell us about everyday life on the frontier, which are amazing, and have things like birthday invitations. And the earliest writing that we know was actually written by a woman.
Ah.
It's from right at the northern border, not from the centre of Rome itself. That's a please come to my party invitation.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, also things that are interesting to ancient historians, but kind of mundane every day. We've ordered this many pikes in.
Yep.
It's really important for that kind of thing. And there are lots of sort of fascinating museums up there now. And it's a really beautiful area. It's incredibly lush and green. It's incredibly lush and green because it rains a lot. And we used to go on school trips and it always rained. And you think this must have been great for the Roman troops hanging out here in the fog and the rain. But if you go there on a nice day, it is gorgeous.
So we've got nothing in Dio about Hadrian's Wall, do we? But we do have something in the Augustan histories. So point one for its accuracy. Anyway, what does the Augustan histories tell us about?
Well, remember that Dio in by this part is epitome, so we're not getting everything from Dio.
So he could have mentioned it in the full extent.
He might have, and he hasn't been epitomized.
Yep.
But we do have
in a monastery somewhere. Yep.
A relatively lengthy quote from the Augustan history, and although probably not as much information as we'd like. So the quote is from 11.2 of the Life of Hadrian. And so, having reformed the army quite in the manner of a monarch, he set out for Britain. And there he corrected many abuses and was the first to construct a wall 80 miles in length, which was to separate the barbarians from the Romans.
So he never stuck around to see it being built. You said it took 10 years to build, so he never saw it completed.
He didn't see it completed, but that's probably true of so many ancient buildings that were started by someone and Certainly the emperors we've been going through, buildings that are named after them, often they've been completed by the successor.
Yes, yeah, of course.
Think about the fact that Vespasian never saw the Colosseum opened.
And Domitian didn't get his forum.
No.
But the only other thing that I think is a bit strange about it is all the building projects that he does throughout the empire, not just in Rome, but everything that he does on the huge scale of the Pantheon and everything, it's a wall. It's a functionary wall that he is best known for that's got his name there on it, and that if you mention Hadrian, people go, right, Hadrian's wall.
Mm.
And that's what he became known for. Maybe if he knew that that would be the case, he might have put a bit more effort into it, or he mightn't have built it at all.
I think part of the reason is the British Empire became so powerful and used the classical world for its education, its inspiration in many ways. And the fact that they've got that massive bit of Rome in their own country kind of gives it that extra prestige and name recognition. But it's also the size of it, of course, the fact that it can last so long. Think of all the temples that have disappeared, and anything that was made out of wood is gone almost instantly. But this is a massive stone structure. Still a lot of it left today, and quite near where I grew up, there's a place called Wall's End, called that because it's at the end of the wall. So he's still having an influence upon the naming of towns even to this day.
And it was white.
Yes.
It was white. That would have been amazing to see.
Must have looked gleaming against the green landscape.
Yeah. So now Hadrian leaves Britannia, takes his retinue down through Spain, stays in his uncle and auntie's guest house, then goes across, sorry, I'm blaseing this a bit, but then he goes across to Syria to quell the Parthians down and calm down the Parthian client king. Now Hadrian's going through the African provinces and surveying the land down there and visiting the cities and the towns and not wearing head covering. So what's he up to here? Is it just more visiting kind of thing? Tell me what he's going through.
Well, partly he's visiting places like Cyrene, which are Greek foundations. So he's already kind of in the Greek world.
Mm.
You might not automatically associate that with Africa, but there are Greek cities there, particularly on the coast. He also is spending money there, as he does everywhere, so particularly in these Greek cities. And he is apparently fortifying this area too. So not quite in the same way, partly because the distances are so much greater, not the same way that he has in Britannia, where he just built the big wall across the neck of land, but much more strategically walling off, apparently, the very fertile arable land to protect it. But it's kind of the mirror image of what's happening in Britannia, that at the other end of the empire, we don't know what's beyond here. We know there are possibly hostile peoples, so let's just make sure we can fortify and keep this safe. And that perhaps reflects a Hadrianic policy. The north and south extent of the empire have to be kind of maintained and retained, and make that easier by fortifying those areas.
It's very much defining the perimeter of the entire empire, isn't it?
It is. And there are lots of discussions amongst ancient historians about how the Romans actually defined their frontiers. And it doesn't seem as easy as looking at a map as we might think of doing now. And maps were very different in antiquity anyway. But Hadrian is doing something that we're much more familiar with. He is making a line. It's not just a line on a map. It's a line on the land in a couple of places.
This only just occurred to me that it's not just making a line. It's not just building a wall. You've got to have soldiers at these walls as well.
Yeah.
And so it's really keeping the army active and busy and making them, giving them a lot of territory to cover.
It is, but it's sort of more like almost like a peacekeeping activities, as we would call it now, for armed forces. You sort of associate armed forces with warfare to a certain extent. But these days, a lot of the places that the army is sent are to try and do the opposite of that, to try and make sure that doesn't happen. And you could read Hadrian in that way. In some ways, in as much as emperors are popular or unpopular in history, he's been quite popular in the late 20th and early 21st century because he seems to have this multicultural, let's rule over peacetime and stability kind of idea, rather than let's go out and conquer.
All right, so what else is he up to in Africa in the East?
Well, this seems to be the time where he met someone called Antinous, who is, he's not from that area. Well, he's from the East. He's from Bithynia, from Turkey, who becomes his boyfriend, his boy love, and apparently the main love of his life, a very beautiful Greek boy. In the East, he also founds a city and names it after himself, but himself performing a particular activity. He basically calls it Hadrian hunting, Hadrian going hunting, and gives it the great long name Hadrianoutherae. This is one of the many times that Hadrian starts to build or found places and name them after himself or someone close to him.
Was there good hunting there, was there?
Apparently, yes. Clearly he enjoyed it and decided that that was going to be what it was remembered for. He had a successful boar hunt there.
So we're now in 124, 125 CE, and Hadrian spends a good couple of years just bumming around the Greek coast there, doesn't he?
Well, he does more than bumming around. He gets very, very involved in Greek culture.
This is the main place, I suppose, that he wanted to visit, because he's had such a long fascination with Greece, and now he's got a good reason to go there and to make his mark on it.
Yeah, remember that his childhood nickname was the Little Greek. So now he's finally got a chance to immerse himself in the place that he loves so much and the culture that he admires.
So what does he do when he's in Greece?
Well, he does get very involved in Greek culture. He builds a lot of buildings, but he actively gets involved in Greek religion, for example. So he is initiated into the Eleusinian Mysteries, which is a cult, a religion with ritual. He gets involved with this set of rituals, which is dedicated to the goddess Demeter, so the goddess of the corn. But it's a mystery cult. So if you're not initiated into it, you don't know what they do. So we don't know what they do.
Yeah.
It's something that is very closely associated with Athens. And although Hadrian travels around the Greek world, it is at Athens that he specifically spends a lot of time, builds a lot of buildings, and clearly wants to associate himself with Athenian culture, classical culture of the 5th and 4th centuries in particular. And he clearly derives a lot of joy out of that and wants to be associated with it himself. So being initiated into these mysteries is part of that, part of linking himself to the great Athenian past, which in a way, he's not the first to do this. Mm. Augustus had done it in various ways through the kind of art that he uses to have himself portrayed. So it's been there all along with the emperors. But Hadrian is the one who does it most. He spends the most time there. He spends the most money on Athens. You wonder if he couldn't have been born again, whether he wouldn't have just spent his life at Athens.
On his entire trip throughout the empire, he's been establishing a lot of building projects. So this is something that he really does a lot of in Athens, or in Greece in general, isn't it?
In Athens alone, there are around 100 dedications, so inscriptions that have been found that show that Hadrian had dedicated a building to be built. And that's a huge number in the couple of years that he was there.
What's a couple of the big examples, maybe?
The most important example is the Temple of Olympian Zeus, which he completed. The building of the Temple of Olympian Zeus had begun in the 6th century BCE.
Wow, okay.
Hadrian completes it, 800 years later?
Yeah.
Is my maths right? 700 years later.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge statement. There's this thing that's sort of there half built or barely built that's just been sort of left, presumably to decay as it would over centuries, never finished. Sort of reminds me of the, there's one of those Gaudi churches, the cathedral in Barcelona, the Sagrada Familia, which they're still finishing.
Okay.
It's been going for about 100 years, but yeah, not as long as 600 or 700 years.
He doesn't just finish building it. He puts four massive statues of himself outside it, doesn't he?
If you're going to finish it, you've got to make it clear who did it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So there are always markers, inscriptions, or lots of statues of Hadrian actually been found all around the empire because he had lots of them made. Actually, even to say he had them made is a bit misleading because it seems that local communities were often very grateful and they would pay for statues of Hadrian to be put up. They wanted this to be on display, that the emperor had given benefactions to them. They wanted that commemorated. So, yeah, the Temple of Olympian Zeus is the special case in terms of, and it is a huge temple, a massive temple, big statement. Hadrian only did big. Hadrian's Wall is massive. The Temple of Olympian Zeus is massive. Hadrian also built the biggest temple ever built in Rome. He's leaving this behind him as a big statement, and that's why there are these four statues of him out in front of it.
So he's not just there immersing himself in the culture and putting his name on the city. He's also trying to encourage political reforms. So what's this in aid of? And what kind of position does Greece hold in the Roman Empire as well? It seems a bit like they've got a fair bit of autonomy.
Well, there are three Greek provinces, and they are in a way on the same footing as other provinces, but they're always very highly regarded because of their cultural authority.
Right.
So they've kind of always got that special position for the Romans. And of course, Athens in particular has this history of a very particular constitution. I mean, not throughout all of its history, but it has that period of 100 or so years where it's a democracy. We have a lot of thinkers, a lot of philosophers from the Greek world and from Athens in particular, who have kind of thought through what is the perfect way of running a state. So people like Plato, who wrote A Republic, which influenced Roman philosophy. So we've got a case of a people that the Romans admire, and they've got a lot of written texts showing that they've thought about political constitutions. And we're told in the sources that the Athenians asked Hadrian to come and look at the way that they were being run and to kind of assess it, to bring in political reforms.
I'm sure they asked him.
It's like he's a management consultant brought in to have a look at how things are running.
Yeah, so he's trying to bring back a bit of the glory days of the Greek.
Possibly. I mean, something he does is, again, he kind of writes himself into it, because the Athenians traditionally had been divided up by, we call them tribes, but the Greek word is phyle, and they vote in those tribes. Voting is not as important, of course, under the Roman Empire as it had been under the Athenian democracy, but they've still got this tradition of being divided up in this way. And Hadrian adds a tribe, and it's the Hadrianic tribe.
Right.
So there you go. He's kind of inserted himself into their political institutions and kind of overwritten it so that it becomes this real hybrid of Hadrianism and their traditions.
Well, that's a lot of Hadrian for 2 years for Greece to put up with. It's not a good way to put it, but did Greece love Hadrian as much as he loved them?
The kind of evidence we've got, of course, the kind that survives, shows us that they were very, very grateful, because they've got all of these honorific statues of him.
They've got a finished temple.
Exactly. And he puts money in other ways. You know, he supports the games, things like the Olympic Games and grain supply. So, for example, Rome, if you live in Rome, then you are assured as a Roman citizen a certain amount of grain dole, usually just money by this period.
Your breads and circuses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Athens gets the same thing. Mm. Now, most of the provinces don't get that. He puts his money where his mouth is with regard to Athens and Greece, and they are grateful for that. At least on the face of it, the very public face shows that they were more than happy to have Hadrian there carrying out these benefactions.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University, and you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. Please leave a review there and tell your friends about it. You can subscribe to the sister podcast, When in Rome, in which we discuss places and buildings in the Roman Empire. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, have a chat there about Hadrian, and marvel at all the damn mosaics that I seem to be posting at the moment. And you can also follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we look at Hadrian the Builder, the Husband, and the Lover. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.